So first I'll continue and finish with the dark matter, and then I'll tell you a little bit about dark energy, but not too much. And that will be the end of the first part. So yesterday I showed you basically two experiments which proved that there is dark matter. And so what is now believed to be that the matter in the universe, so this omega m, which is rho of matter over rho critical, is believed to be about 0.26. And out of that, actually, baryons are only a tiny fraction. So omega of baryons is 0.04. 0.04. And radiation is basically negligible. So the rest actually, so now in order to have k equals to 0, which is observed, you need to provide something like 0.7 of other matter, and that will be the dark energy, as we will see later. But we are still discussing just the dark matter, so basically why we have lots of matter here. And I just want to warn you here that at this point, well, all these experiments I mentioned yesterday, they are based on using gravity. Okay? And so the only observation up to date of dark matter is basically gravitational observation. So there are basically two possibilities. Either there is real matter and we have to explain what this matter is, or there might be something wrong with our descriptions of with our description of gravity. Okay, so at this point, the only evidence, for dark matter is gravitational. Gravitational. And so we have two possibilities. So one possibility is that GI is wrong. And people probe, well, theoreticians really probe this possibility, and they try to modify Einstein equations, and you replace the Einstein-Hilbert action, which is just R, the Ricci scalar, with, let's say, some polynomial of R, function of R. That's one possibility. Or you can play with higher curvature terms of other type, and so on. So this is definitely a possibility. Or the other possibility is that there is really dark matter. And then people are in favor of two main candidates of the dark matter, and so they have funny names. So the first one is called MACHOS, which is an acronym and stands for Massive Compact Halo Object. Okay, so this is Massive Compact Halo objects. And so what do you mean by that is that, well, an example of such an object would be a black hole. So it's something which is microscopic, which is massive, and which you cannot see. Okay, so for example, a black hole. Or the other possibility is called WIMPs. Which stands for weakly interacting massive particles. So, which are really the like fundamental particles that are massive, and that only weakly interact with this other matter in the standard model. So they basically interact gravitationally, but all the other interactions are very, very weak. Okay? So these are like two main candidates for dark matter, if there is really dark matter. Another possibility is actually, you know, maybe our description of gravity is wrong. Yes?
Why is halo important in the matrix?
Good question.
It's a nice
acronym. Is it?
It's like the correlation between the acronyms.
I know.
It's Okay.
So. Yes.
I mean, there were a lot of black holes in galaxies, you know, like small black holes. Wouldn't we notice their effect on the stars around them?
Yes, we would. I'm just going to do that.
Oh, you're about
yes.
to. Okay.
Yeah. So I just want to say a little bit about Matthias first. So there is a very nice paper, and I actually created a link on the wiki to this paper so you can read it by Paczynski, which actually exposed the possibility that the Matthias would be actually observed by gravitational lensing. Okay, so these, if they exist, they could be observed. Not only by gravity, but like a gravitational attraction, but by gravitational lensing. And the guy is, so C, I put that link on the wiki if you are interested. And it's very readable paper, and it's short paper. So Paczynski. And so what basically happens is that if you observe your favorite star and you look at the intensity of that star and you observe it for some time, then as long as there is nothing in front of that star, which like this macho object, then the intensity is constant. But as the macho passes by in front of the star, then actually there's this gravitational lensing. And due to gravitational lensing, the intensity actually increases for some time. So we really observe a pattern like this. And people are looking for these patterns. So really observe, you know, if you are paid, why not to look at one star, right? So you look at one star for a long time and you are really, exploring whether the intensity, whether it brightens or not really. Okay, so from here, So this would happen as dark matter goes in front of my favorite star. Okay, and actually this imposes very very nice restrictions on how massive these black holes might be, how massive these machos might be. And so, in fact, the following range is excluded. So if and 10 to the 2. So basically, these are excluded, ruled out. So basically, you cannot have black holes in this range of the masses, which is, this is really a big range, right? So the solar mass black holes be somewhere here, and then you can go up to 100 times some of that. And then you can go to much smaller masses, 10 to minus 8. And still this is all ruled out because simply these things do not happen as you would wish for. Okay. So now, machos are unlikely bigger than 100 times of mass of the sun. So you can sort of, you know, logically extend this to infinity. So here you are fine. So also if you had black holes, it would be really, really tiny. And if Hawking is right, they would evaporate very quickly. Okay. So black holes with mass which is smaller than 10 to minus 19 with 10 to minus 19 solar masses would already evaporate. Well, that's another restriction. But however, you still have the window in between 10 to minus 19 to 10 to minus 8. But there is still a window for much else. But another problem actually comes from this Big Bang nucleosynthesis, So that gives you, well, how many baryons were present at that time. Okay, so if I really observe the abundance of the elements, I know how many baryons were present. And so this happens like 3 minutes, 3 minutes after Big Bang. Okay, so that number of baryons correspond to the number of baryons which we see at this point. So you would have to create these black holes earlier than 3 minutes. And that's another problem. That's another restriction. Okay, so there's still a window. There still exists a window. But due to constraints, from Big Bang nucleosynthesis, this is statistically unlikely. So really, also it's a very nice idea that it could be black holes, and especially pleasing me because I like black holes and I study black holes. It's probably not black holes, which are the dark matter. Okay. So now let me tell you a little bit about WIMPs. Yes?
Could there not just be not black holes, just like planets?
Or yeah, exactly. So this search, So this search would discover planets as well.
Right, but that
thing wouldn't work. Yeah, I agree. So I'm saying unlikely. I'm not saying disproven. I'm saying unlikely. Yeah. Yeah. So this is like the size of Pluto, I think. So you know, can they be smaller than Pluto? Maybe they can. If they are, you know, maybe some asteroids or whatever. Yeah, it's possible. So now you have two big categories of WIMPs. And so first category, that they are an athermal relic. That means actually that it's some kind of particle which we don't know yet, but in the past of the universe, in the early history, it actually at some point it was in thermal equilibrium with the rest of the mass, of the rest of the matter. So originally, in thermal equilibrium, this other matter. And then you have two possibilities, basically. So now, at some point, this equilibrium with this kind of particle broke down, and so the particle decoupled from the rest of the matter. And you have two possibilities. Either this happened when the particle was still relativistic, or it happened when it was already non-relativistic. Okay? So you have two kinds. So hot thermal relic. So when the particle decoupled, it was still relativistic. Decoupled when still relativistic. That means that the temperature, that this happened at a temperature which was much bigger than the rest mass of this particle. And you know, an example of this could be neutrinos, perhaps. So people thought, okay, neutrinos are a good candidate as long as they are not massless, as long as they have mass, maybe this is a good, you know, good candidate for a hot thermal relic. Or the other possibility that it was cold, which means that it was already non-relativistic. Okay, so this was, and T is much smaller than M. And so an example of this would be LSP, which stands for lightest supersymmetric. Particles and so you will study this case more in your homework number two. And so what is actually nice about this possibility, there's something which is called WIMP miracle. And so you will explore this possibility in your homework too. But what it tells you is that, you know, this setup is sort of very natural in the cosmological setting. So you don't really have to tune many parameters, but it's sort of like naturally everything fits in. Okay, so this will be your homework, and maybe you'll discover dark matter in your homework. So the second big category of WIMPs is, well, we have thermal relic or non-thermal relic. Non-thermal. And that means, you know, such particle was never, ever in thermal equilibrium with the rest of the matter. And an example of this will be axion. A mystical particle that you will study tomorrow in the tutorial. Okay, so C, tutorial 4. So that's another possibility. And so, you know, these are two favorite categories. Okay. So because you study in your homeworks and in your tutorials, cold thermal relic and non-thermal relic, then let me tell you a little bit about hot thermal relic very briefly here. That's the simplest one, so I'll do it here. So more on the hot thermal relic. And a nice thing about this one is actually that it's ruled out. It cannot happen. Okay, it's ruled out. And the reason why it is ruled out is basically you'll find out that, well, because the particle when they decoupled it was still relativistic, that means that the mass of the particle cannot be that high. Okay, and if the mass of the particle cannot be that high, it would actually, so remember when we were plotting this power spectrum for CMB, so these peaks, these Doppler peaks, whatever, I told you very briefly that they depend on the distribution of dark matter at the time. So the dark matter created like a gravitational potential for the plasma, which was oscillating around. If the dark matter particles are not so massive, actually, they wouldn't create the potential wells which would be deep enough. So you wouldn't observe oscillations of that type. So if the dark matter particle is not so heavy, then you wouldn't observe the power spectrum of CMB as you observe it now. And so this is the reason. So let's see how massive it can be. So at the time, by definition of freeze out, it's still relativistic. Freeze out. The particle, let's call it chi. And it has mass m chi, still relativistic. So now what it means is that from freeze out till today, freeze out till today, the ratio between the number of particles and the entropy of the radiation is conserved. So if the number of particles chi is conserved, then its density goes like 1 over 8 to the cube. But the entropy density of the radiation goes also like 1 over 8 to the cube. So that means that n of chi divided by the entropy density of the radiation at the time of the freeze-out must be the same as today. So basically, I'm doing the same calculation as you did yesterday on the tutorial, but simpler one. Okay. So from here, I can read what nchi today is. So nchi today is just S0 times nchi at the freeze-out over S at the freeze-out. So now we know from our magic formulas, which we derived some time ago, that S is given by this magic factor G times 2 pi square over 45 and today's temperature cube, which is the relativistic entropy today. Then m chi at the freeze-out was g chi, again, some magic number, and then zeta function of 3 pi square and t at the freeze-out cube. And finally, S of F is G SF 2 pi square 45 DF cube. So now another assumption comes in, which is sort of, well, it's experimentally shown. So today, the dark matter actually is cold and non-relativistic. Okay. It's cold. And non-relativistic. That means that the energy density of the dark matter today is just given by the non-relativistic formula, which is mass of the chi particle times the number density. Okay, so now this number density is expressed here, and you have to plug these formulas in. So now you see that TF cube cancels from the formulas, and the only thing which remains there is the mass of chi and T0 cube, and then some numbers. Okay? So this thing will be proportional to M of chi and T0 cube. So now what you are interested in is this factor omega, which is the energy density over the critical energy density today. So omega chi 0, by definition, is rho chi 0 and rho critical now. Okay, so it's m chi 0 divided by, so now rho critical today, we know from the Hubble parameter. So that's 380 square h pi. And now for the Newton's constant, I plug m Planck square. Okay. So this is what it is. So now what you need to do is you need to plug some numbers. Okay. So you need to plug in that you know that T0 today is 2.7 Kelvin. You know also what GS0 today is. That's how many particles, how many degrees of freedom in relativistic particles are. It's approximately 4. And, you know, other things. You need to plug in what H0 is and so on. So G0 is something like 3.91. H0 is parametrized by the small h. So it's 2.13 times 10 to minus 42. Oh, my God, what are the units here? H11 GeV. Okay, and then M Planck is 10 to the 19 GeV. And then T0 is I don't know, 2.35, that corresponds to 2.7 Kelvin times 2 minus 13 GeV. Okay, so you plug all these numbers there into this formula. And when you get out of that, of course, you don't know what G of chi is, and you don't know what Gs of F was at the time that it freezes out, because you don't know when exactly it actually froze. So let's keep those there. So it's G chi over GSF. But there are some numbers which are of the order, let's say 10 or 100 or 10. Okay. And then the number which you calculate out of all these things is 10 to minus 2, and then H100 square, and then M of chi measured in EVs. Okay, so it's like 10 to minus 2 here is something which is of the order of unity, let's say. This is of the order of unity, and then you measure M chi in electron volts. So now you know that dark matter is approximately 1/4 of the total energy content in the universe. So you know that omega chi 0 is definitely smaller than 1/4. So if I plug for omega chi 0 to be exactly equal to 1/4, you get an estimate of on how big this m chi can be. And from here, you find out that m chi is smaller than 10 electron volts. So this estimate tells you that, you know, because I require my particle to be still relativistic at the freeze-out, then there is a serious bound on its mass. It cannot be more massive than this guy here. But as I said, I'll try to explain to you, this will certainly rule out the CMB power spectrum. So if it were that light, I'm not proving this to you, maybe Kurt will, then the CMB spectrum would be ruled out. So what it tells you, this calculation really tells you that, okay, so if it is some fundamental particle, some fundamental massive particle, when it decoupled from the rest of the matter, it would happen when this particle is already non-relativistic. Okay. Questions? Yes?
How do you measure all of those?
Okay. So you know this guy.
G, so it's 3.91.
So this guy is, you know, how many degrees of freedom in relativistic particles now? So now you basically have neutrinos, maybe, and photons, and that's it. So everything else is non-relativistic. Okay, so you just count how many degrees of freedom in
that's
photons.
3.91.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You get this 7/8 or something like that. For fermions, I think it includes some neutrinos probably. This estimate, yeah. Yes, it's a good point.
And what's
H100? I didn't use it before. So people, when they talk about the Hubble expansion rate, you remember that Hubble expansion rate has units, so. The velocity is h times delta L. So h has units of kilometers per second per megaparsec. Okay. So now, and I told you that h here is something like 70 kilometers per second per megaparsec. So however, you know, it's not for sure that it's 70. It may be 72, it may be 75, it may be 65, whatever. So that's why people actually said, okay, so let's get the units right. And let's parameterize the uncertainty by small h. So basically you say that big H is like small h times, let's say, 100 kilometers per second per megaparsec. And this small h is something like 0.72. It's now a dimensionless thing, and it's of the order of unity. So that is what this H100 is. I never introduced it. Sorry for that. OK, so now politically incorrect joke. So you probably know that Finns and Russians, they don't really love each other. So this story might have really happened. And now you know what pushkar is. So it's something which is on the rails, and you have to push it from both sides so that it actually goes somewhere. So a Russian guy is trying to get to Helsinki in Finland. And so at some point, he gets lost completely in the forest, in the deep forest in Finland. And so he wanders around for several hours, completely lost, completely exhausted. But at some point, he finds the rails. And he's really, really lucky, because a Finn is coming on this pushkar, and is coming by. And so, oh, good man, could you please take me with you? I'm lost in the forest. Can you please take me with you? And tell me, please, how far to Helsinki? To Helsinki? Not very far. OK, so he jumps on the pushkar. They start pushing up, down, up, down, up, down. They push for 1 hour, 2 hours, up, down, up, down. 3 hours, 5 hours, up, down, 8 hours. Russian guy is completely exhausted. Please tell me how far to Helsinki. To Helsinki? No, it's very far. Okay. So a few words about dark energy. So that's part F, I believe. Dark energy. And so it was already noticed in the 80s, actually, that something is fishy and wrong. And so what people actually knew very well is that they already knew the content of dark matter. And they knew the content of baryons and so on. So in the 80s, this is not a proof of dark energy or anything. It's just that something is fishy. Okay, so they knew that rho of matter, which was rho of baryons plus rho of dark matter, is approximately equal to 0.3 rho critical at that point. So now if you use your Hubble, your Friedmann equations, then, and if there is no any other matter at this point, so radiation is negligible, so if there is no lambda, no dark energy, no nothing else, then the Friedmann equation tells you that k must be minus 1. So we live in an open universe. So if no lambda, then k must be minus 1. And so now you have a very well established model. So k is minus 1. This is your matter content for the universe. And so we can calculate everything just using Friedmann equations and so on. So in particular, you can actually establish what is the age of the universe. Age of universe from the assumption that k is minus 1. This is the matter content and so on. And so what you find out that this t is 8 times 10 to the 9 years. Okay, this is a simple calculation based on this model. Okay, so people were very happy about that until they discovered objects in the universe which are much older. Okay, so what people discovered is globular clusters. Clusters, and which is like an agglomeration of 10 to the 5 stars or whatever. And so the age of these is actually 13 times 10 to the 9 years. So it exceeds the age of the universe. So something is, you know, fishy with this model here. So now we know actually that the rho total is approximately rho critical. And that means that 0.7 must be hidden somewhere else. It's actually hidden in this lambda. So rho is rho critical. So we need really a lambda, or we need some additional energy density to have rho equal to rho critical. Okay, so this was just, you know, a very brief motivation. But let me do, you know, seriously, one calculation, one more calculation for you, and I'll do it from the very beginning till the very end, because it can be done in 15 minutes, and it was awarded a Nobel Prize. So in 15 minutes you can get a Nobel Prize, basically, or in 10 minutes maybe, you understand that. Not really, I'm just. So really, the experiment which convinced people that universe is accelerating and there is something like lambda is from measuring supernova. And so you have different kinds of supernova. And so a particularly nice one is 1A, I don't know what it means, observations. And so this was awarded Nobel Prize in 2011. So the measurements were done in 90s, 98, whatever, 96, 97. And then in 2011, these people already received Nobel Prize. So it's good. So now what is the whole thing is about is basically that people are trying to plot graphs which measure on one axis the redshift z of how far the object is, and on the other axis, how dim the object looks like to us. So on one axis, you have the apparent magnitude of the object, and on the other axis, you have z. And so what actually happens is that the luminous distance is larger than if you have lambda in the universe. So if you don't have lambda, it would be shorter, and the magnitude would be bigger. If you have lambda, all the stars look more dim. They are dimmer. Okay. So, and that's the whole thing. That's the whole trick. People calculate it. So what we are trying to do is distance versus redshift. And so we will do that for these particular standard candles. So it is assumed that all these type of supernova, they have exactly the same luminosity. So L is always the same thing here. And so what I'll show to you is that luminous, well, not really, but if you calculate the integral I give you, then you can find out that luminous distance is larger in the presence of lambda in dark energy dominated universe than without lambda. And so this is what really people measure and observe. Okay, so how they proceed is that they say, okay, so let's our universe be a Friedman-Robinson-Walker universe. So let's assume FRW universe. So the metric is ds square is a square of eta in the conformal time and minus d eta square plus d chi square plus this weird function, which depends on k, is either sine or sine h, or it's just a function, square of chi, and then the angular part. And I also remind you that if you want to relate the conformal time to the normal time, then this is the time used by the commoving observers, and it's related by e to a times d theta. Okay, so we assume this, and so let's just calculate how much flux is observed from the star. Okay, so calculate observed flux. And it'll be from the source of this supernova, which is source with luminosity L. Source with luminosity. Luminosity L. And so let's also assume that the source is commoving. And it's commoving at some chi fixed. So this is commoving, and it will be at chi emitted. So this is some constant chi where the star is, and then yeah. So this is fixed. So now. So now within, so it's better to not to deal with this time here, although it's a commoving time, but it's better to actually calculate everything in terms of eta. And why? Because you'll be interested in photons and photon propagation, and you know that photons in conformal time, they propagate very nicely, the radial ones. So if you have no angular thing here, and you have photons, this is equal to zero, so d eta is plus minus d chi or something like that. So that's why I'll be using eta. So anyway, so within delta eta, so within this time, and within this conformal time, let's say that the supernova emits delta E emitted, which is, of course, the luminosity times the time, delta T emitted, which is, in terms of the conformal time, it's L times A times delta eta. Okay. So now you probably remember when we studied the geodesics in FRW, I showed you that for relativistic particles, the energy is proportional to the spatial magnitude of the momentum. And this is proportional to 1 over a, the scale factor. So we derived this relation when we were studying geodesics. So now what it means is that if I take a product a, well, e, the energy times a, it will be constant. Okay, so e times a is constant. So that means that if I know delta e emitted, I also know delta e observed, which is delta E emitted times A over A now. So far, so good? Okay, so using what this delta EM is, this is equal to L A square delta eta over A zero. Okay, so now, what is the observed flux? Let me draw a picture. So this is our, well, artistic impression of a supernova. So this is our star. Okay, it's exploding. And you know, let's say that it emitted this energy, delta E emitted, during this delta eta time. And so at later time, you know, this will be a shell of the radiation which is observed here and now. Okay. And so how big this shell is, or how long it lasts, because everything propagates is the speed of light, so it's the same thing. So delta t of shell is equal to A0 times delta eta. Okay? And the whole surface of the shell is that I have to use this metric to calculate the surface. So that means I just take chi equal to 0 and eta equal to 0. So if you calculate using this metric element, it will be a square, a chi square, and then 4 pi. Okay, so the area of this shell will be 4 pi. Now, at the time when I observe it, it's a0 square times okay. So now what is this flux here? So flux is the energy per time per area. Okay, so it's delta E observed divided by the area of the shell at the time when I observe it, and delta T of the shell. So it's energy per time per area. Okay. So now you plug everything here, so you know what delta E observe is. It's that guy. You know what S of shell is at the time. And you know what delta T of shell is. So now what it gives you is L over 4 pi. And then from there, you still have A square. And then you have A0 there. But you have also A0 square here and A0 here. So there'll be A0 to the 4 power. A0 to the 4, and then you have SK square. Okay. So, yes?
Can you describe this as more? The energy of the T as more quantities?
Oh, you just, you know, take some infinite, well, you can do it infinitesimally. You just consider it like small time, small conformal time during which this expansion radiates that many radiation, and you just observe that radiation. Yeah, so yeah, you can make it T if you want, but yeah, it is, yeah, doesn't. Okay, so now this is basically the final formula, except now, well, this guy is actually at chi emitted. So SK at chi emitted square. So now, the only thing is that this is still not a function of Z. It's still not a function of the redshift. So you need to write it as a function of redshift. So want this as function of Z. Okay. So you almost know the answer. So I showed you that for the cosmological redshift, A0 over A goes like omega over omega 0. Now we can add 1 or subtract 1. It's plus 1, minus 1. It's still true. So now if you take, it's better than minus 1, plus 1. Anyway, so if you take minus 1, it's omega minus omega 0 over omega 0, which is Z by definition, and it's plus 1. So if this is equal to Z plus 1. Okay, so now you know how to relate A to Z. So I already know how this guy actually relates to Z. So the only thing I need to know is how chi emitted actually relates to Z. Okay, so for that, let me differentiate this equation. So I have that dz equals 2. Now I differentiate this left-hand side, which is minus A0 over A square dA, So far, so good. So now I divide by dt and multiply by dt. dt dt. So I have a dot. I borrow one a, which will create h. So this is equal to minus a0, 1a is still there, and then h and dt. Okay. Okay, so now we also know that you have null geodesics. Thanks. That means that, and if the light is coming towards you, then it's data d eta equals to minus d chi. Minus d chi. If it were plus, it would be going away from you. So you are always at chi equal to zero as an observer. Okay, so that means that chi emitted of z is an integral from minus e emitted to zero d chi. So this is definitely true. Chi at zero is zero. Chi emitted is what I'm writing here. And this is equal to the integral emitted to zero of d eta. Okay, so now I use the relation between eta and t. So this is e emitted to zero dt over a. Okay, so now from here, I see that dt over a is dz over a0 and h. Okay, so from here, I see that this is equal to, and there is a minus sign there, and the minus sign will swap these limits. Okay. So this will be equal to from 0, 1 over a0 from 0 to emitted. And then d z prime h at z prime. OK, just using this formula here. OK, so now I know how actually to express this chi emitted if I know what h is. But I know h from my Friedmann equation. So where? H square is equal to 8 pi g over 3. And now the total matter content of the universe. Okay. And now you can always, so this has definitely units of h0 square at now. But you know that rho total consists of radiation, consists of matter, dark energy, whatever. And you know how these things actually behave with respect to A. You know that the radiation goes like A to the 4, 1 over A to the 4. The matter goes like 1 over A cube. The K term goes like 1 over A square. The lambda term goes like A to the 0. Okay? So in other words, you can write it as a sum over all matter contributions. Now, the whole thing here must be dimensionless quantity. So it'll be rho of the corresponding quantity. And then for A, I'm plugging this 1 plus z to some power. So 3, 1 plus wi, where this wi is p over rho. In particular, so if I take matter wi, is equal to 0, so it will be a to the cube here. So a, this is a to the cube. So now, if you use this formula, so you know how to express h in terms of z. So from there, you know how to express chi emitted as a function of z, and you just plug it into the formula for the flux, which is over here. So now, this is really, flux is a function of z. So this is f of z now. and so on. Okay, so this is the formula which will win you the Nobel Prize. So now the only thing what you have to do, what is left, is actually to do the experiment. So now, okay, one more thing. So this is the flux, but people don't like flux. People don't really measure flux because I doesn't measure flux. I measures logarithm of flux. So you see, you know, twice as dim object if it's actually 10 times less bright. Okay, so people either like luminosity distance, so people like either the luminosity distance, and you see both types of graphs, so that's why I put both of them here. And so that's defined. So if you know the flux, then the luminosity distance is given by L over 4 pi F. So L you know because it's a standard candle. So F you calculate as a function of Z. So you have T as a function of Z. Or even better, astronomers like apparent magnitudes. So these really tell you, you know, how the object looks like on the sky, how much brighter this object is than that object, and so on. And this is M, and it's minus 2.5 logarithm at the base of 10 of the flux. So again, you know M as a function of Z. And the logarithm of 10 is because DI is a logarithmic device. Okay. So now we can plot Z with respect to, let's say, M or D, doesn't matter. And so you have the formula for F of Z. So you have M of Z formula here. And so for once you fix the matter content, so once you fix, you know, these numbers, let's say 0.34 matter, 0.74 dark matter, once you fix the corresponding WI, then you can plot theoretical predictions. You can write a computer program, you know, playing, changing these things, and, you know, plotting how M looks as a function of Z. So then you get something like that, depending on which parameters you choose. So this would correspond to different cosmological models. And you can probably find some movies on the internet which would actually show you if I choose omega m to be 0.3 and omega lambda to be 0.7, it gives you this. If you choose omega lambda to be 1 and omega m equal to 0, then you get that curve and whatever. And so now you have to do the experiment actually to observe the real objects. And let's say it's this one here. So this is really what you observe for supernova. And so, and the line will be statistically right if rho of matter is 0.3 and rho of lambda is 0.7. Okay, so I have no time. And this is how you get your Nobel Prize. So now, this measurement was done in 1990-something. They got the Nobel Prize 2011. But the truth is that it's not the only measurement of omega lambda at this point. So you have now all other measurements, like the CMB, and then you have also baryon oscillations and so on. So there are quite a few experiments, and so they all give you like a load range for omega lambda and omega m, but they actually intersect somewhere, and that's the picture people really like. So I wanted to show you some pictures. So first, this is the measurement. So you see. how the data are not great, but you can really play with the prediction, theoretical prediction for omega m 0.3 and omega lambda 0.7, or you change them to something else. And depending on that, you get different curve, this one or that one. And these are actually the measurements of the real supernova. And so you see that, well, this one is probably really not happening statistically. Whether it's happening this one or that one, it's a question. But you have to do the statistical analysis to see which one is actually the most likely. And and the conclusion is that this one is actually most likely here. Okay. So now people plot it in different graphs. So again, you have the same data. And then you see that really the red region is sort of statistically disfavored. And it's really the fact that we have some vacuum energy and the universe is actually accelerating. This is another graph. So I only talk about supernova, and they give you basically this region. So this is a plot of omega matter versus of omega of dark energy. And so this is what supernova give you. But you have an independent measurement of these things from CMB, which is this one. And then you have it also from the clusters from baryonic oscillations. And so they all intersect approximately here, which gives you that omega matter is 0.3 and omega dark energy is 0.7. So now you have like several experiments, which all combined together actually give you that this is the right thing. Interestingly, this is also a similar experiment, but similar graph. But you see that here is the dark energy density. We want 0.7. But also, it doesn't assume that it's really lambda. So lambda, the equation of state for lambda is this W is equal to minus 1. So P over rho is equal to minus 1. So you now allow this P over rho to be, you know, from minus 0.5 to minus 1.5. And again, it seems that really dark energy behaves sort of like lambda. So it's really, you can make this graph. And again, various sources give you different results. Okay, so this is about that thing. So finally, because this is the last lecture, I wanted to show you this thing. So this is the cosmology of ancient times, right? So in particular in Greece. So this is how, you know, people thought the cosmological model looks like in Greece. This is how it looked like in India. So you have elephants standing on a turtle carrying the earth. But of course, this is how it looked in ancient Israel. And then in ancient Maya, right? So this was. But of course, we have done many scientific experiments, and we went through the. Okay, so this is east again. So we have. I really like this thing here, where you see that you had to have an ocean above so that actually it could rain. So you would just open that thing, and it would start raining, appearing, or whatever. And so, of course, this is the underground. Anyway, so since then we went through the scientific period. Right, so this is what we think now, and I really try to convince you that we don't have any special place in the universe and so on, and that you can scientifically explain everything. So in the end, we come to today's perception of the universe, which is that of Terry Pratchett from Discworld. So this is us. So thank you so much for your attention, and you may be looking forward to Kurt's lectures tomorrow.